Session number 11486, rule 6.
I made a speech and threatened. Then just thought, why on earth couldn't they have managed to kill him? That was my reaction. It seemed very bungled. It was. Then, of course, you only heard of them being, well, you heard the official version who was killed or not. You also heard that the families would be affected. One thought of it as dreadful. Some of it was made public, some of the trials, and you knew that they would probably be done away with in a dreadful way. One didn't hear an awful lot of it, although at the university was one young man who'd moved from München University, where they had the student of the Weiße Rose, the White Rose, which was a resistance among students. They distributed leaflets, the Scholl, Sophie Scholl, and her brother, and a circle of friends who distributed anti-Hitler leaflets, and they were arrested, and they were shot, and that you only heard this by rumor. Well, a student who'd been there, he'd moved university, and he knew about it all, and he told us. So one knew there were things happening, but one didn't hear such a lot. Obviously, propaganda wouldn't make much of it, because that so many high-ranking officers had tried to kill Hitler, of course, would not be a thing they'd wish everybody to know a lot about.
Of course, during this period, while you were at Heidelberg, D-Day occurred.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I wonder, you know, did that make a big impression?
Yes, it did. It rained. It rained and rained and rained. And one of the women studying with me had a husband who was in it, and so she was pretty petrified all the time. But I think we were quite callous, because we had to cancel some festivity because of it. It was deemed not to be proper. And one heard of it. I suppose one had cut down versions of it. I suppose one heard about the heavy fighting, but didn't quite know how it was actually going. I personally was relieved to hear that it had happened. It seemed to bring the end of the war a little closer. One thought, well, if the Americans have landed, it'll be a lot of troops and a lot of material, and things will get moving. But that's really as much. And then, of course, there was the V1 and V2. Then there was a lot of talk in connection, I remember, that what it was called, the secret weapon, Hitler called, was near completion. And I think V1s were shot off. And there was a lot made of those, that they were actually doing a lot of damage and so on. But one didn't know a lot about them. But the promises that they were so wonderful that they would finish the war off, that was the impression given. I don't think it was believed by many people, not at that stage.
Going to tell me about your life after Heidelberg, aren't you, Inga?
Yes. As I said before, as soon as I started studying, we already knew that I couldn't stay on, because the first and the early semesters were not allowed. We now had total war, and only the people who were near their final examinations could carry on. So the possibilities were working on the land or working in industry. And as I came from the industrial part, and I wanted to be home, quite a strong feeling to always be home, back at base, my father was able to get me a job in the research laboratories of his firm, which obviously was a jolly good idea. And I suppose I was lucky. Other people might have had very unpleasant work. Mine was very nice. I worked in the research laboratory in metallurgy department, which of course wasn't my subject, but it didn't really matter. I was quite interested. I did micro and macro photography. We worked underground because by this time, of course, we were very heavily raided all the time, day and night. I got very friendly with the girls who worked there, and I worked at, I did some testing of nuts in a turbine wheel. We had to set it into some plastic and grind it and polish it and then photograph it and to see whether and how it had they had corroded. So we had a 56-hour week, which was quite long. The men worked 60 hours. So I went in the dark and came home in the dark almost. And I was paid the standard unskilled worker's rate, and later on I was deemed to be semi-skilled and got that. Money never mattered, really. I can't remember really thinking about the money. It was quite amusing to have it, but it didn't really make any difference to my life. You couldn't buy anything, and my father earned money, so it was no problem. We had air raids. We had to dash across to the big bunker that the works had and hope to make it in time. I remember once lying outside in a huge pile of people because we were too late, and you weren't let in then, because if a bomb fell, there would be the blast would be going through it and that would kill more people inside. So we were a huge pile of Russians and French and Germans and everybody who was working there, and then were left in. But it wasn't terrible. I don't know, one sort of accepts these things in wartime. The family was together, which was very nice because one felt that was very important. I actually remember Arnhem happening in September. It was a Sunday. My father got notification of it because he was in charge of air raid protection for the works, that there had been a landing at Arnhem and everything was on full alert, red alert or whatever it was called. And he had to dash off to the works, and we wondered what would happen and thought perhaps this might be the end of the war, or at least some decisive thing. But then, of course, nothing happened, so life went back to, what was called normal in those days. I worked there till early March 45, or may have been end of February, and we were all dismissed because work wasn't possible anymore. The war had progressed to such an extent that they didn't do any more research, or superfluous people were dismissed. I got a certificate to say I'd worked there and was dismissed for general reasons like that. That was in March, or I don't know, may have been February. Very shortly before, in fact, as far as I was concerned, the end of the war. It was a time where one was entirely geared to hoping the war would end. There were heavy air raids. One was being shot at day and night. If you had during the day low flying aeroplane who would take a pot shot of you if you walked through an area, as it were, so you flung yourself on the floor and hoped they would miss you. Also, from the 1st of March onwards, I think the Allied troops had reached the Rhine, and one had artillery shooting. Now, that was, of course, new. So one used to walk along roads, keeping a building to the towards west, so you knew you'd be protected there. But all these things became sort of automatic, and one arranged life accordingly. I've just checked this last time I was at home. On the 23rd of March, my father got an order to, it was called to lame the works, that means to destroy parts of it. And he was then said he would be taken out of there, away from incoming troops that would obviously disapprove of it. And we all didn't want to go because there was nowhere else to go in Germany. After all, the Russians were definitely advancing well from the east, and everybody met in the middle. But nor did he want to destroy the works, was not prepared to do that. But in that night, the Rhine crossing started. On the night from the 23rd to the 24th, we had the most fantastic artillery bombardment. I think later on the Americans explained it. They shot a sort of fire bell across the Rhine under which they crossed then. And that went on for, hours, from, 12 at night till the early morning. And then there was a stop, and that meant we were all tied to home, so there was at that stage no pressure anymore for my father and us to leave. We still got the order to leave. It was a special order for us to leave, and we were told we could go on the fire brigade car to get out. They wanted to get people out. That's the amazing thing. In the east, people were prevented from going. In the west, we were all made to go, or they tried. And then on the 24th in the morning, we had the last air raid, which in fact almost flattened the town. At 11 o'clock, I think it must have been a 1,000 bomber raid, with carpet after carpet. And it was incredible. We sat in that bunker, and it was as though the earth moved. And this was 3 meters of concrete all around you. And nonetheless, it was absolutely quiet. You could have heard a pin drop, almost, in spite of what went on outside. Of course, you didn't hear that much. And when we came out, once it was over, the light went, of course. It was 12 o'clock at noon, and it was dark. There was so much churned up of houses and dust that you couldn't actually see anything. It's sort of an amazing thing. And then obviously that cleared, and we then could see the damage. Our house was damaged but not destroyed, and various other houses were completely destroyed, and there were enormous bomb craters. It was sort of like a moonscape around. But our bunker hadn't been hit. It had quite near hits, but it was all intact. And we didn't know. My father wasn't there. He was at the works. He didn't know how we'd survived, and we didn't know how he survived. And one sort of gradually moved out and tried to get information from the next road. It's amazing how in this sort of century you can be almost cut off from the next road because you can't physically get there except over mountains of rubble. But once more, one sort of coped. There was no water, no gas and electricity after that. That had all been cut off. But we had an old range in the kitchen, which we hadn't used, but which we could light a fire on, so one could do a spot of cooking. One didn't know whether there would be another raid, so one was always prepared to dash back into the bunker. But my father somehow made contact, and we saw him. And there were public soup kitchens. One could fetch some hot soup. I remember going and fetching some hot soup at some stage, and my sister remembered the same. I can't really remember what we ate or how we cooked. It seemed quite immaterial. That was on the 24th. And then there was a sort of eerie silence, except for artillery, no more bombing. And a day or so later, the police went. There was no authority left in the town. They were all moved out. And some German troops came through, but they only stayed in the cellars, and they didn't come in formation. They sort of came individually, left their weapons behind, which we found, and departed, ate some food and departed. So we had to cart those weapons out and dump them in a bomb hole because we didn't want to be found with a cellar full of weapons. There were some anti-tank things, huge long things with big heads, which we had to cut up. A bit scary because you didn't know whether they wouldn't go off. We didn't see anything of my father because he was at the works. He had to cope with the big air raid shelters there, the big bunkers where there was thousands of people in there. Under some pressure to put out the white flag, which would have been a very dangerous thing to do. Also, the last party bosses left and were searching for him because he hadn't done anything to destroy the works, place explosives. So he hid, actually. He went somewhere and hid behind some machinery until they'd gone, or he thought they'd gone. And they didn't want to leave it to the last moment. And life sort of went on like that until the first Americans came. Funnily enough, we'd always thought they'd be the English. And suddenly the first Americans came in a huge tank. One had sort of heard rumours where they would be, but they arrived sort of on a... it was a sort of early morning. There was a bit of mist around. And of course, one went into the street to see. I wasn't really scared. We had, in the meantime, put out a white flag, one of our tablecloths. Very funny, actually. One gentleman had written on the bunker, civilians only, because it might have been a military installation. It looked like that. So you put civilians only on the outside. We didn't want a hand grenade thrown into it. And there they came in their tanks. And the first I heard was when they said, "Hi, Blondie," to my sister, who was very blonde. That was the first American, and really very friendly. They then occupied the town, just completely peaceful. There was absolutely nothing. I mean, they just drove in and told us, of course, the town was overbombed because they couldn't get through. They had these in various of the little towns on the Rhine. They had a slow progress because they couldn't move over all the rubble. And we still, after that, had some German artillery, of course, now coming back, but that wasn't much. And the Americans settled in, all very, comparatively friendly, amazing. They came and searched for weapons, as they said, but what they really wanted was a chat. My mother spoke English, so we had quite a lot of talk, and they explained how they put the Ruhr in a packet, which, of course, we all had learned the proper English, and this was suddenly American, which was very funny. And then the next danger, really, were the, thousands and thousands of displaced persons, which were there, which were full of hatred, very naturally, having had a bad time, except for the French and Belgians. All they wanted was to get home, and they did, and they just departed, as it were. But the Russians were around, and the Poles, and there were long trails of them with mattresses on their heads for the night's sleep, who came and did a fair bit of looting and raping and killing. But the Americans didn't want that to happen. They wanted peace. So they put them into a camp and moved them on as well pretty soon, because they didn't want any uproar, as it were. They wanted to quiet. They in fact came and helped. One or two of those Russians obviously came to the house and knocked on the door, and we used to dash out of another door to post, American post quite nearby, and said the Russians, and he used to come with his Sten gun and threaten them, and they went. It was amazing, really, how friendly they were. Now, I must always say, if one has to be occupied by anybody, let it be the Americans. They came and they were quite keen to just talk. They came one evening, I remember, two young Texans, I suppose they were students, just came into the kitchen. They brought coffee and said they wanted to chat, and we sat in the kitchen and talked, in our kitchen and talked. Quite amazing, really. It was, after all, only days after the end of the war, as far as we were concerned.
Had you been very apprehensive beforehand? Do you know what sort of treatment you would get? You know, you were saying how you expected the British rather than the American. Well, you know, waiting in this bunker with all the artillery and knowing they would arrive, I wonder how you all felt and what the atmosphere was like.
No one wasn't scared of them, really. The one thing I was scared of was house-to-house fighting. I always was terrified that that would happen, as it had happened in towns, in other towns, obviously, that had been defended. We all hoped that the towns wouldn't be defended and that they would just march in. And then one wasn't afraid because, in fact, one had had reports from the other Rhine side, of course, the other side of the Rhine. For sometimes, even when they were already occupied, the telephones hadn't been cut, and there were people who actually telephoned across, just the odd thing when it happened. And one knew that nothing dreadful had really happened. Well, if they'd been fighting, that was a different thing, but not just to civilians. So no one wasn't really scared of that, not of the occupying troops, as it were. One knew they wouldn't be Russians. I think one had all the terrible reports from there. Also, one knew it wouldn't be French, who were thought to be harsher, less friendly. I don't know why we expected them to be English. One always just thought they would be. I don't know why. And in fact, of course, it was became later the English zone. It was just that the troops had moved that way. And they'd come. They were a parachute regiment. They had jumped not very far away, they told us, full of pride. They were some crack regiment and had come down to then occupy for a bit. But I've forgotten how long they stayed. They were soon replaced by the British, actually, I think probably in May. And military government immediately was British, which came then.
Was there any sort of law and order from the German population, you know, during this period? There seemed to be this period when the Germans, you know, the Nazis left, the fighting people. You know, was it a situation of anarchy?
Well, it was a sort of interregnum. The German forces of law, just the ordinary police, had left. The party officials left. Oh, they didn't do much for law keeping at that stage. Anyway, there was some looting, apparently, by Germans off German shops. But on the whole, people were so scared of artillery and air raids that nothing much happened, because they felt they wanted to keep safe in their houses or cellars or bunkers. I think that's probably why not much looting happened, although some most certainly did. The business with putting the white flag out was really rather awful. A colleague of my father's, who was in exactly the same situation, he put a white flag out too early, and he was dragged out of the place and shot by the last sort of party officials still there. So you had to time it pretty exactly so that everybody had left before you put the white flag out. And he was under some pressure from all the French that were in the bunker and the foreign element to put the white flag out. But he didn't. He timed it right, and all was okay. And he handed the bunker over to some officer who came in to the occupying.
You were saying also the worry about the displaced persons, you know, who were milling around until they were controlled. You know, did you yourself have any worry, any immediate worry from anyone?
Only in as much as they came by the house and kept a low profile, and they did knock on doors trying to force their way in, but they didn't have any tools to force their way in. So one sat tight, and we had the American post nearby, and therefore we felt protected by them, and in fact, I suppose, were up to a point. Yes, that was a bit scary.
Were there cases of rape, though,
yes,
in your town?
Yes, there were. There were, and some killing, and a lot of looting. But there'd been so much violence in one form or other, it was just one more thing that happened.
This night as well, you know, of the heavy artillery, when you knew that, you know, things would be happening the next day, I wonder what it was like in the big bunker. You know, what were you all... You were in there for some time, obviously, the whole night.
Oh, yes. And yes.
What was the mood, the atmosphere like?
Well, apprehension, pretty disciplined. There was nothing you could do but sit in there. One talked, made small talk. We then, in fact, slept all in there. It was quite well organised. We had... facility for sleeping in things you hang up. What are they called again?
The hammocks.
Hammocks as well in our bunker there, and we tried to sleep. We were probably in the bunker for a good 5 nights. We sort of came out during the day and did bits and pieces and slept there, all of us, for safety at night. And a lot of people, of course, just sat and. In the bigger bunkers and sprawled about, but there was a basis of discipline because everybody knew one had to get through that, something would happen, and there was.